All right, this is Marvin Storm, the host of the Business Exit Stories podcast, where we explore the stories of business owners that spend decades building their business and then often fumble the ball when they get down to the one-yard line, while others are able to put the ball into the end zone. These stories are told by dealmakers and transaction specialists that help business owners get into the game and develop a game plan that successfully allow them to exit their business. Today, we're with Joe Santora. Joe, will you introduce yourself and your firm?
Sure. Yeah, my name is Joe Santora. I am with Transworld Business Advisors. We are the world's largest business brokerage. We have over 200 locations in 13 different countries. I am in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Okay, cool, Joe. Will you share with our audience here a transaction that you have been involved in recently, which really didn't go according to plan, and provide some background about the business and the seller and kind of their motivations for selling?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I was working with a business owner on an automotive aftermarket parts business. His focus was on higher end automobiles. And it was an e-commerce, Amazon and eBay business. Had a great business set up, relatively low overhead. The Amazon products were housed in their facility, and they shipped them direct to consumer. Obviously, Prime has certain requirements to make sure that it receives it in 2 days. Everything else was drop shipped directly from the vendors, so it was able to keep their overhead relatively low. His motivation for selling was his family had a long-time business that had been passed down from generation to generation, and his parents were getting ready to retire. So he was interested in selling his business and taking a little bit of time off to spend with his young children and then going over and taking over the family business.
When you say the business had been around for a long time, in kind of what format? Was it a retail type of location, a garage, warehouse?
I'm sorry, their family business, not the one that was listed for sale, had been around for a long time. It was a service-based business unrelated to the business that was being sold, but that was part of his motivation for wanting to sell the business. The business that was listed for sale was around for established and in place for about 5 years.
And how fast did the business scale, and what was the size of the business as far as employees or revenue?
So they were doing around $1.2 million a year in revenue. And they were doing that with the owner, one full-time employee, and a part-time admin that was doing their books.
Yeah, that's actually quite a bit for that type of business.
It really is, especially when you're dealing with that small amount of employees.
And kind of what was their customer acquisition model? How did they acquire customers? Primarily being, I guess, an online business, they probably were very active in advertising and social media.
Actually, no, surprisingly not. So they originally started off with eBay. And as the eBay fees started to increase and people started transitioning away from eBay to Amazon, they really started focusing on driving the Amazon portion of the business. So they did have, with that transition, they had 1 year where they had a decline in revenue because they were moving from eBay and really growing on the Amazon side. But once they did that, business really kind of skyrocketed from there for the next couple years. What they were doing is when they were sending the packages out, they were putting coupon cards in the Amazon boxes and steering them directly towards their website. So they were getting a lot of repeat business from customers that were going direct to the website instead of going to Amazon, which increased their profitability because they don't have to pay the Amazon fees.
For our audience that really isn't familiar with this type of business, both on eBay and Amazon, could you take just a few minutes and talk about, one, you know, how eBay kind of works as far as the fee structure and environment that people market in and their target markets? On eBay, you can buy things that are new and you can buy it right now, or you can buy it as part of an auction. And a little bit about the Amazon world and how that's kind of different.
Sure. So with eBay, you have individual sellers, you know, just your average Joe that is selling random things, could be new or used. And then you have eBay stores, which are set up, you know, similar to like an online store within the eBay platform. This particular seller had an eBay store had built a very big following, had a power ranking rating with eBay. eBay allocates a star rating to sellers. And the more you sell and the more positive reviews you have, the higher that rating gets. And was selling new higher end aftermarket parts for higher end automobiles. And so when a consumer was looking for a particular part, whether it be a part number or by description, you know, they would find his listings and they would purchase through eBay.
Okay, cool. And you know, in contrasting that to, you know, the Amazon world, you mentioned earlier that fees were escalating in the eBay world and people were migrating over to Amazon. Are their fees less or just another platform to sell from?
It's more or less just another platform to sell from. But with Amazon, people have transitioned to and shop in a completely different manner than they used to years ago. And Amazon is really a good channel for sellers that are selling goods to be involved in because you have paid users that pay an annual subscription to Amazon to be able to shop on their site. One of the benefits to the consumer is that you get free 2-day shipping on all Amazon Prime items. This particular seller was a Prime seller, which Amazon changed their policies a few years ago, and it's very stringent now and difficult to get in as a Prime seller. So that was one of the really added bonuses or values to the business was that they did have a very strong presence on Amazon. They were a Prime customer and store, and it's harder and harder for people to get in with Amazon with their current structure, you know, to be a Prime seller. And when you have a Prime item, when a consumer would go onto Amazon and search for that part number, they would show up in the top of the search results. The purchaser was able to just click a button and add, and it was shipped to them, and they would receive it within 2 days.
So give me a little bit better idea of the actual product that they were selling, you know, from a description point of view.
Oh, I mean, it could be anything from windshield wipers to, you know, air filters, oil filters. They were, you know, water pumps. I mean, it was just about any kind of replacement part that you would need for a vehicle, with the exception of, you know, major components like axles, transmissions, engines, things like that.
Well, Amazon can sell just about anything. It's quite amazing.
That is correct. Yeah.
And so motivation for selling, they approached you, a referral, or did they just find you by searching online?
Yes, they found me searching on Google and saw my Google rankings and reviews, and so had reached out to me, and we had a couple initial consultations just discussing the process and everything that was involved before we listed the business for sale.
Would you and, you know, your experience say that they were ready to sell? They knew what the process was, or was there a lot of coaching that went into this transaction?
So when I sit down with a seller, I get them up to speed on what the process is before we get into listing. So at that stage, yes, he understood what was going to be involved, how long it was going to take, what we needed to do to get from point A to point B.
And how did the transaction go?
The business did sell, but it did not sell for nearly what it could have. There's some reasons for that. The seller made some pretty big mistakes in the sales process that really cost him on the sale price of the business.
Well, those are always interesting stories and one we like to hear and delve into. So why don't you give us as much, you know, context to those type of decisions and things that were done that didn't enable the seller to maximize the value of his business?
Absolutely. So the business was being marketed and advertised as a relocatable business because they just had a small 2,000 square foot warehouse. The lease was almost up. The business could be moved anywhere. We had a couple people interested in the business that had flown out and you know, met with me and the seller, and had expressed a high interest in purchasing the business. And the seller had good intentions. In his mind, he wanted to make the transition easy for whoever purchased the business. So he started to dwindle down his inventory. The problem with that is that the majority of the inventory that they housed were Amazon Prime items, and that was a large percentage of their sales was through Amazon Prime. So because those items were not in stock, people obviously were not buying them. They weren't being marketed, and the seller took a dip of around $40,000 a month in revenue as a result over the course of about 90 days, unbeknownst to me. And we found this out once we had got under contract with a buyer and were in due diligence.
And so just to be clear, all good intentions in the world, it sounds like, if the business is going to be relocated, to make it easy for the new owner to relocate the business and not have all the inventory to worry about. And the unanticipated consequence was nothing on the shelf, nothing can be sold.
Absolutely. So obviously we found this out during due diligence, and the buyer, of course, freaked out because it looks like the business is in a severe decline at this point, and wanted to withdraw from the transaction during due diligence. Ultimately, that wound up being what happened. He just got too scared. But one of the things that I did attempt to try and do to resolve the issue is we were going to add some contingencies where a large portion of the proceeds of sale were going to be held in escrow for 90 days. And if the revenue levels did not get back up to where they were at, the purchaser would get that money returned back to them. If the revenue levels did get back up, they would then go to the seller. Unfortunately, the buyer did not feel comfortable with that. And so we parted ways on that transaction.
So when that was discovered, the reason for the dip, did they restock inventory?
No.
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 All right. So let's talk about that. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, after we got it out of due diligence with that particular buyer, we were under contract within a matter of a week with another buyer. So there wasn't really time and or need at that point.
Okay. And I assume that the sales price was adjusted somewhat?
I would say so. Yeah, it was less than 50% of what the original offer was.
Holy smokes, that's a hit.
It is, yes.
And how did the buyer respond to that? I mean, what was his reaction? Did he understand the reasons behind it and didn't really want to do anything about it?
He understood the reasons behind it, but he was just very motivated to get out of the business. I think he enjoyed what he was doing, but he didn't enjoy being a business owner. And while he would have preferred the other offer that was at a substantially higher price, there were certain things about this particular offer, even though it was lower, that were attractive to him. And one of those was that they retained him to do customer service with a base salary, for a couple of years. And he liked that aspect of it because he was able to continue doing what he enjoyed doing, and that is dealing with the customers, but he didn't have the responsibility or burden of actually having to manage or run the business. So it was a larger company that bought the business, and they had the infrastructure to really be able to support the business.
So I would imagine that a larger company, being a little bit more sophisticated, kind of understood the dynamics of the reason for the drop, and didn't really bother them all that much, and they were more than willing to move forward because they could make the adjustments accordingly.
That is correct. But of course, obviously, it had to be at the correct price for them, and it was based off of what current revenue was, not what the revenue was before. And that's what most sellers need to understand, is a buyer is willing to pay for what we can prove. And what we can prove is what the business is doing right now.
Just out of curiosity, was the prime seller designation for the second buyer a consideration, or were they already a prime seller?
They were not. It was a consideration. And so was the brand name and the e-commerce portion of the business. So the larger company made aftermarket parts that they sold to wholesalers that branded it. The wholesaler branded the part to their name. So this company was not direct to consumer. They were selling bulk to wholesalers. And the thing that interested them about this company is that they could actually create their own brand, sell to direct to consumer now through these channels. And of course, because they're going direct to consumer instead of selling bulk wholesale, much higher profit margin for them.
You know, just in the manner, Joe, that you talk about this type of business, you know, you're quite knowledgeable on this online sector here. Have you done a lot of transactions in the online world, e-commerce world?
I've done quite a few, yes.
And traditionally, what is kind of the multiple that people look at as when it comes to evaluation of the business?
There's a lot of variables that come into play when you're looking at multiples. You know, one of them is the size of revenue and profitability. The higher revenue and profitability of a business, the higher a multiple it's going to sell for. It's also going to depend on the, you know, how involved the owner is in the business, if the owner is the business, or if it can be run, you know, either absentee or semi-absentee. But generally speaking, you know, we typically like to look at around 3x adjusted net.
All right. Well, that transaction got done finally, albeit at a lower price. Not the ideal outcome, I guess, for the owner, but still, as you said, highly motivated. And I guess he got to continue doing what he liked to do, and that's work with his customers. So shifting gears a little bit here, is there a transaction out there that went according to plan and were all the stars lined up?
There was. There's one that actually lined up very well. The business was a custom millwork fabrication business. The owner started his career actually out in Hollywood building movie sets and decided, you know, after working, you know, 3 months on, 2 weeks off, 3 months on, 2 weeks off, 70 hours a week when he was younger, wanted to get away and have more of a normal, I guess, so to speak, hours. And so he moved from Hollywood to North Carolina and started doing trade show displays. And that actually eventually he was doing it out of his garage, and then eventually just opened up a shop, and the business kind of grew and escalated from there. And they transitioned to they still do trade shows, but they do a multitude of other things. They do a lot of restaurant build outs. So when a restaurant franchise or a chain decides that they want to change their look and rebrand, they will typically go to a rebranding company that will help them create a new design for what that franchise is going to look like. And what this company does is they actually build those looks for these companies. So they're doing that for several restaurants and storage companies. They do a lot of PGA tournament tents, the big booths at the PGA. So it's a very unique business model as far as to what they're doing.
So their actual customer isn't restaurants that are rebranding. It's the companies that are the rebranding agencies that work with those type of companies.
So it's a combination of both. I mean, sometimes they're working direct with the franchise, and the franchisee is the one that is paying the bill to have the store built. They work very close with designers and rebranding companies, have very close relationships with them. So a lot of times those companies will bring clients to them and say, hey, this is a company we worked with in the past. We highly recommend them. And then they worked direct with whoever the end user is. So no middleman or pass through.
So in this situation, was it a locally based business, or were they, you know, having construction take place all over the state or country?
They're doing all over the country, primarily the Southeast, but they are doing things all over the country.
And so in that type of situation, did they send their own crews out, or did they find a local contractor that would become the general on and supervise the construction?
They have their own installers that they send out. And depending on geographically where the job site is, they will either drive or the crew will actually go out there, fly out there and do the install.
So is this kind of like they arrive with everything that's shipped out and they do all of the remodeling and construction in a compressed time frame where it's a matter of days or weeks and the job is done?
So what they're typically doing is they're building everything in the warehouse here in North Carolina, and then they will load it up on a truck and have it shipped to the job site. The installers will actually meet the trucking company at the job site, unload the truck, and then do the install. And just depending on the particular job, it could be anywhere from 3 to 7 days for them to complete a job. But everything is pre-built ahead of time, so they're just going ahead and just doing the final install.
A very unique niche and specialty-oriented business to be able to do that and pull that off in that time frame.
It is. And one of their clients that they're working with now that's doing a major rebranding on all of their restaurants is extremely excited to be working with them, because prior to them getting involved, a lot of the stores were being built by the general contractor on site. And what was happening, it was taking on average around 6 months to get a store open. And now they are able to get a store open in 3 to 4 months. And so what that does, obviously, the biggest thing is the franchisee who just bought the franchise is investing all this money in the build out. The faster they can get those doors open and start to make their money back, the better it is for everybody. And so being able to shave 2 months, 2 to 3 months off of the time it takes to get a store open has really been a huge help for not only the franchisee, but the franchisor as well.
So in that type of situation where a new business is opening and they're building it from ground up, who's responsible for all the local permitting and construction planning?
So they have the franchisor has a crew. It's they call it their Ocean's 11 crew. So they have a national contractor, that's basically the GC that's doing that. They've got an architect, they've got the millwork company and a couple other professionals that each one of them has their responsibility and role.
So in this situation, all the plans come from the franchisor and they do the build out and do the installation.
My client, it was responsible for the skin, and the shell was done by the general contractor. They would come in and do the walls, the POS system, the countertops and tables, all of those things, soffits, things like that. So the skin of the restaurant.
And how were you introduced to these folks?
The seller's fiance actually found me online and called me, had an initial conversation with her, and then she put me in touch with her fiance, and we sat down and met. I toured the business. Really, it was like a kid in a candy store. I mean, the amount of tools that they had at this facility, how many times it would have saved jobs for all the work that I've done at my house, being able to have access to that kind of equipment. I was fascinated.
So how big of a facility did they have?
It was a little over 20,000 square foot.
And what was the motivation? I mean, it sounds like they were doing well, expanding, great opportunity down the road.
Sure, yes. So his motivation is, he's been doing the business for almost 20 years. Kids are off to college and relocated. His fiance, who is now his wife at this point, lived in a different state, and they were traveling back and forth for the past several years. And he's just ready to retire and kind of live life. So that was his motivation.
So this type of business, and you described a little bit of his background coming from the West Coast to the East Coast and starting from scratch, did the business scale quickly or was it a long, slow build and then kind of took off at the end?
Their revenue has consistently grown. Now, I typically only go back about 3 years on the financials when I'm working with a business owner. They're just looking at their revenue over the 3 years and then current year to date, it was at a continuous climb, not a skyrocket, but definitely a sizable increase each year. And I think the first few years that he started off, he probably saw some pretty high escalation at first, and then it just continued to grow from there.
All right. So we now have a business that looks like it's a solidly profitable business, kind of the right motivations to sell. Not really a downturn or any external forces forcing a sale. Time to kind of step away from the business and allow someone to take it to the next level. Who were the interested buyers? Were they larger companies, other construction companies, or just individuals?
No, as an individual looking to escape corporate America and go into business for themselves. An individual had a background in actually marketing, and his motivation for the business was, obviously he saw the consistency in the revenue, the profitability of the business, but also looking at it from a marketing perspective, he saw some scalability and strong growth potential about the business. One of the unique things about this business, even though that they were continuously growing in revenue, they were not doing any marketing or advertising at all. All of their business was either repeat or referral business.
You have a good situation to be in. The right person, right opportunity.
That is right.
So this person's coming out of marketing. We're dealing with a construction-oriented company here. I imagine there are licenses involved. How was that issue handled?
So the seller did really made some very strategic moves during the course of having the business listed for sale. One of the things that he did was to make the transition easier for a purchaser. This business was funded through an SBA loan. And so with SBA, they have pretty strict requirements for a buyer, and the buyer's got to have transferable experience.
For our audience here, SBA define that?
Yeah, SBA is a small business administration. It's a government guaranteed loan. Now, the government doesn't actually loan the money. It's a bank or a lender that's going to fund the transaction. But they work with SBA, and SBA actually guarantees the lender on that particular loan. So the lender has to meet some very strict guidelines that SBA sets for that buyer. And one of those restrictions is that they like to see transferable work experience or experience within that particular industry. So in this particular case, with it being a custom millwork business, somebody that has had experience with, you know, something construction related or building related would have been considered transferable experience. This particular buyer did not have that. So going into what the seller did to really kind of set things up to make the transition easy, again, he was looking at it from kind of two sides. One, you know, what is a buyer going to need to be successful? And B, what do I need to establish if I'm not able to sell the business? And so what he did was he promoted one of his guys in the shop to a project manager that was actually running and overseeing everybody in the that was doing all the building in the warehouse, and took that off of his plate and worked very closely with, you know, for months to get this gentleman up to speed to be able to manage that portion of the business. Then he brought somebody else in who has experience doing what he does, and that is quoting jobs, dealing with the customers, and you know, running some of the operational aspects that the owner was currently doing. And so he set the business up really to be run absentee. If he did, you know, so if he didn't sell the business, he was able to relocate with his wife and be able to come back occasionally and the business still sustain. So by setting up these key employees, that was a critical component for the buyer to be able to get his SBA loan because he had those two key employees in place.
Well, that's just, you know, quite remarkable. I mean, not only from, you know, strategically thinking of who your buyer is going to be down the road and what the requirements are, but also, I guess, being savvy enough to know what the requirements of the SBA were going to be, and that if that hadn't been there, his pool of buyers would have been very limited.
Sure. Well, and that's, some of that comes from working with the proper broker to be able to help guide you through the process and let you know what your options are and things that you need to do within your business to make sure that you do have a successful transition. One of the remarkable parts about it is that because the business was growing so much, even with the increase in payroll for these key employees, there was actually absolutely no change to the net profit of the business. So therefore, we were able to get asking price or near asking price for the business, no loss in profitability, even with adding key employees on salary.
So in this situation where there's an existing SBA loan in place and a new buyer coming to the table, was there a complete refinancing of the business, an assumption of that SBA loan, or walk us through the mechanics of that?
There was no SBA loan on the business initially, but to answer your question, in the event that there is an existing SBA loan, that loan would be paid off at closing. Typically, whoever's managing escrow, usually a closing attorney, would disperse those funds directly to the debtor. And so the seller would get a payoff statement prior to closing that would be incorporated into the closing documents, and the closing attorney would send those funds to pay off the seller's debt. SBA loans are not typically transferable, so it's going to be a new loan for the buyer.
Just wanted to clarify that to make sure that our audience out there realizes criteria around an SBA loan and issues involving transfer of those type of loans. And so from the time you listed the business for sale and it was successfully closed, a sales transaction, how long did that take?
We were, let's see, about 7 months from list date to close.
Well, that's a happy outcome. You know, kind of a guy from Hollywood having a Hollywood ending, huh?
Yeah, I would say.
Well, Joe, in your experience, when you look at buyers out there that approach you and start talking about perhaps selling their business, what percentage of those buyers do you think are really ready, both emotionally and from an organizational standpoint, to get to the closing line and selling their business?
I would probably say 25% to 30%.
And what are the biggest barriers that a seller faces in getting the business ready for sale?
One of the biggest ones that I encounter, particularly when you're dealing with smaller Main Street businesses, is the seller is the business. And when you have a situation like that, you know, we call it a hub and spoke model. It's everything is dependent and reliant on that seller. And at that point, the person that's purchasing it, they're buying a job and not necessarily a business. And so that makes the business a little bit less marketable and desirable for most people, or for most buyers, I would say.
And like the example that successfully closed here in the construction sector, he anticipated that, and it sounded like he was at one point in time kind of the business, but transitioned to a model where he was able to put in key employees to make himself replaceable, I guess.
That is correct, yes.
And in those type of situations, does that change the multiple and the valuation of the business?
It certainly can. Absentee owner opportunities are highly desirable. There's, of course, larger companies, strategic buyers that are looking for opportunities like that. But then you also have private equity groups that are looking for opportunities where they can invest in a business or an opportunity that they don't have to actually run. And so, yes, the multiple can increase quite a bit when you're dealing with businesses that are self-sustainable without having to have daily interaction from an owner.
You mentioned a term there that some folks might not be familiar with, private equity groups. Why don't you just touch on that and talk a little bit about what those type of funding entities are about?
Yeah, private equity groups generally are set up with a multitude of individuals that decide that they want to go into business together. Usually they'll create a corporation or an LLC, and they'll invest funds into that entity and then utilize that entity to go out and purchase businesses. And they look at it as an asset. So they're looking for cash flow and ROI, return on their investment. No different than somebody that's looking to invest in a rental property, for example. They'll purchase a rental property because they want to get that recurring revenue. Private equity group is doing the same thing. They're looking for business opportunities as an investment and not necessarily for reasons that other buyers would look for. Some buyers are larger companies looking to acquire more market share. Some buyers are individuals that are just looking to exit corporate America. Some buyers are semi-retired and realize they don't want to be, and then they want to get back in the business. And then you have private equity groups that really are just looking for investment opportunities.
And in those type of situations with private equity groups, they take a hard look at management and who's going to be managing the business, because they are not looking to run a business on a day-to-day basis.
That is correct. And strategic buyers, the same. I mean, if you've got a larger company, particularly if they're not within the current market, they're going to be looking for a business that has management in place for them to be able to acquire that opportunity.
Well, Joe, this has been a fascinating discussion. We've talked about two entirely different types of businesses here. One is an online and another one that is very bricks and mortar, dealing with the actual bricks and mortar of a business, kind of a diametrically opposed different types of businesses out there, and certainly with two different outcomes. If there was anything that you could give our audience as a takeaway on what a seller of a business should do when they are thinking about selling a business, just one takeaway, what would it be?
I always advise my sellers that you need to run the business with the same burning passion that you had when you first started it. That's what a buyer is going to want to see. They're going to want to see continuous growth in the business. They're going to want to see sustainability. And when you have a seller that has just mentally withdrawn and they're no longer focusing on running the business, it's going to hurt them when they sell.
If people wanted to reach out to you and chat with you and contact you, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Sure. Phone, email, LinkedIn. My email address is jsantora, that is S-A-N-T-O-R-A, at tworld.com. And my LinkedIn profile is Joe-Santora, S-A-N-T-O-R-A.
Joe, thanks for taking the time today and sharing the stories of your clients and how they exited their business. And until next time, for our next episode of Business Exit Stories, we'll see you then.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marv.